Hey, Steve, recently Bad Boys Ride or Die exploded at the box office, was massive. But I saw a lot of Furiosa fans. I saw a lot of Fall Guy fans who were upset that their films that they love didn't do as well as Bad Boys. And they thought it was unfair. But you know what's not fair? It's the fact that Netflix hides thousands of shows and movies from you based on your location and then has the nerve to just keep increasing their prices on you, which we've seen recently. Now, you could just cancel your subscription if you wanted to. I'm sure you could protest in that way. Or here's an option. You could be smart about it and make sure you're getting your full money's worth like I do by using ExpressVPN.
So here's how this works. Netflix has access to all of these titles, but they hide a whole bunch of them based on your location. They have servers in over 100 countries, but you don't have access to those servers unless you use ExpressVPN that lets you change your online location so you can control where Netflix thinks you are, and then you can have access to the shows on all these different servers. This is super easy to use. You just fire up the app and you click one button to change locations. It works for all your devices, phones, laptops, tablets, smart TVs, and more. The speeds are super fast with zero buffering. And all of this is encrypted, which makes this private and secure for routing all your traffic through an encrypted tunnel.
Yeah, Steve, and I've loved having ExpressVPN because it has opened up a whole new world for me as a lover of TV shows. I get to now watch shows from other countries, shows that usually I have to wait till it shows up on a streaming service months and months later. I get to watch it when they're dropping in real time in those respective countries. Like I get to watch One Punch Man, which I thought has been a fantastic anime. I get to watch Line of Duty. I get to watch The Great British Bake Off before it premieres on Netflix. I get to watch it days earlier using the VPN. It's a fantastic thing that I've loved using. And it's so easy. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, select the country that I want to be based out of, tap one button to connect, refresh Netflix, and boom, there it was.
So be smart, cinephiles. Stop playing full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/cinephiles. Don't forget to use our link at expressvpn.com/cinephiles to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN absolutely free.
Hey, the Cinephiles fans. During the summer, Steve and I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep us hydrated and refreshed, and it really is from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient artesian aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements, Steve.
And as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands. And John, that's what gives Fiji water its soft, smooth taste.
Totally. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water.
So, John, I think we should get stocked up on Fiji water this summer, and everyone listening should pick up some today for your next backyard party, beach day or pool day, hike, or even just for your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
And welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live, our monthly show here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. I am one of your co-hosts, the Outlaw John Rocha, joined as always by my co-host, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing good. I've been limbering up, working on the splits. I think I've got it pretty good. So I feel ready for this conversation.
It's going to be an interesting conversation as we dive into the world of Jean-Claude Van Damme. That is the focus of this show. And you say to yourself, wait, you're the cinephiles, you're the self-proclaimed people who break down one great movie a week or a movie of your choice that is can be in the category of greats, at least very good to greats. Why in the hell are you jumping into a Jean-Claude Van Damme conversation? And for many reasons, Steve, you and I grew up during the heyday of Jean-Claude Van Damme. He was kind of like that other choice. If you didn't want to go Schwarzenegger, you didn't want to go Stallone, which we've been talking about recently on the show for the last few weeks, you go Van Damme. And he made something of himself in a crowded marketplace of the 80s with action stars and found a way to stand out and still endures to this day with his legacy of films, his comedy, and his versatility as an actor. And we're going to talk about all of that today here. So I ask you, Steve, before we start, what are your thoughts in 2024 on Jean-Claude Van Damme, who we got to know in the late 80s, first in Bloodsport, really, unless you had an eagle eye to see him and break in and saw No Retreat, No Surrender. It's really Bloodsport we broke out all these decades later here in 2024, still very much a part of our lives.
So I definitely want to address that, but I see a couple people in the chat saying they can't see me. If I'm still not visible, please let me know and let us know in the chat, and we'll try to solve that problem. Because
hopefully
I'm here. So it's funny. I've been thinking a lot about this, and spoiler: we reveal what our next film is coming on the Cinephiles. We haven't officially announced it.
I thought we had announced it, but if we haven't, please take it away.
Well, whether we've announced it or not, I'm going to announce it again, which is that we are jumping into Total Recall. Yeah. That's going to be our film next week. It's a two-parter. We have an absolutely fantastic guest who is his first time on the Cinephiles, but my guess is will not be his last time on the Cinephiles. And we're talking about Total Recall. And because we were talking about Total Recall, we started to talk about these films that we don't really get anymore, which is these action movies, you know? And so to talk about Jean-Claude Van Damme, you know, everyone who's listened to the show knows that I became obsessed with martial arts and martial arts films from seeing Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon when I was 9 years old. Yeah. And from that point forward, any way I could find another martial arts movie, I would look them up. And so of course I was watching all the Bruce Lee knockoffs. I was watching anything that came out of China. And of course, I was watching Chuck Norris, because Chuck Norris was the American martial arts superstar. Right. And there was this time in the 80s, and Chuck Norris was, you know, getting a little longer in the tooth. And we're heading off to probably Walker, Texas Ranger era soon. Yeah. And was like, well, where's the next martial arts? So anytime there was another martial artist, I was going to see that movie or renting that movie. Yeah. I don't think I actually had seen No Retreat, No Surrender until after I saw Bloodsport. But definitely the moment that Bloodsport came out, it was a really big deal for all of my friends who watched, because suddenly there was a new martial artist. You know what I mean? That was going to be, that actually seemed like they could be a star. Now, is Bloodsport a fine film in the likes of Lawrence of Arabia and Citizen Kane? No, sir, it is not.
No,
but this is the thing, and this was the big epiphany I had when we were talking about Total Recall, is we go to different movies for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of movie where it's like, yeah, we just went to see these fight scenes, and we just went to get excited about this guy and watch how well he moved. And, you know, when the muscles from Brussels showed up, that was pretty damn cool. And you're showing it right now. In particular, he had his signature move, and the signature move was that guy could do the splits, and it was really cool.
Yeah. Much in the same boat with you. I grew up at a time when martial arts movies were massive. You know, I would watch on Metro Media 5 and WDCA 20. I would watch the Saturday afternoon martial arts, Bruce Lee, Bruce Lee, Bruce Lowe, all the different versions of Bruce Lau, all the differences of Bruce Lee that came afterwards. And then, yes, Chuck Norris. Chuck Norris is where you went to the video store to rent Chuck Norris movies. You know, The Octagon, Lone Wolf McQuaid. Those are those things you went and watched when you were old enough to rent them. You rented them, you watched, you got your buddies together, and you watched them, and you lived vicariously through these people. And especially if you were a fat kid like I was, who was bullied the majority of my life until I was 15 years old, watching people who were, in essence, beat up and didn't want any trouble be the heroes of these movies, martial arts movies really spoke to a lot of us who were bullied as kids, because we wanted to live vicariously through these people fighting back,
getting revenge on these evil people, getting revenge on the people who bullied them, on the on how they bullied women and bullied old people and bullied people who were in a lesser situation, financial situation, than they were in the movies. And so you live vicariously. I think that's the gift of martial arts movies. It's not about, it's a, yes, the action sequences are great, but the things that keep us coming back is the story of, hey, this is what it's like to fight back. And when you have the tools to fight back, and sometimes you don't always win in terms of overall. Sometimes you lose things in the process when you're fighting back, but you've got to stand up. As Kenny Rogers once said in Carrot of the County, sometimes you got to fight to be a man. And so you're right. So we, this was the explosion, the 1970s into the 80s. We had all that stuff, and you're right. So right at the tail end of the 80s, we're wondering, where are we going to go next? We've done, Bruce Lee has passed on. Jim Kelly is no longer viable as a martial artist for movies. So where are we going next? We had these action films, and then bang, here comes Jean-Claude Van Damme. And right around the same time as Steven Seagal. So in essence, they were, in essence, our Schwarzenegger and Stallone on a lower scale, right? And so you're like, how, who is going to really bubble up? And both of them bubbled up. And I think the reason, though, and you come back to this, what you were talking about earlier, I want to add something to what you said earlier. The reason Jean-Claude Van Damme endures is because, yes, he replaced something that we needed, a void that was there, but he also had this charm, this personality. Yeah. There's just something about him that you genuinely liked and gravitated to. And I think that is one of the biggest reasons why people still work with him today, or he's popped up in numerous places throughout our lives and is still working today, because there's just something about him that you can't help but like. Even if you know all the stuff that went on behind the scenes and the personal issues, you just love this guy. And I think that's why he's endured, Steve.
Well, this is this weird movie star thing. And that clearly, and it's, and you know, his story, it's not exactly the Rocky story, but the dude was not, you know, when he gets Bloodsport, he, I think he was living out of his car.
Like, he was homeless. He was homeless.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and yet he has this charisma and you know, and Bloodsport, you know, is a perfectly classic structure for a martial arts movie, which is, it is the tournament, and you have the which means that you, when you do the tournament movie, you have a built-in structure, because you're going to have match after match after match, and you can, you know, at the beginning, like, we're going to establish a couple of people that are really good, we're going to establish the bad guy, we're going to make sure that our hero is disrespected, and they don't, you know, and they're going to make their way until they deliver the goods at the end. And he is, it's just as you say, he is an extremely likable character. Mm-hmm. And I think too, I don't think you have Jean-Claude Van Damme without Arnold, because we've gotten used to this guy, a muscular guy with an accent, which when Arnold is coming up, people are going, people are going, there's no way this guy can't, he's got a heavy accent, he can't be an actor. But because Arnold has already broken through and proven, oh yes, you can, Jean-Claude Van Damme comes along, he doesn't have to contend with that. And he is extremely likable. And he also, he has, and I think this is critical for martial artists, martial arts guys in general, is that Jean-Claude Van Damme has a way that he moves.
Yeah.
That is not how Bruce Lee moves. It's not how Chuck Norris moves. It's definitely not how Steven Seagal moves. It is not how Jackie Chan or Jet Li move. It is Jean-Claude Van Damme's style. And and I just have to, I got to talk a little bit more about the splits before we move
on.
For two reasons. One is that split kick that he does, which is in the climax of Bloodsport. It's in every one of these movies. Yeah. And having done martial arts and done some kicks, it is so stupid and such a it's like, you know how they say, like, evolutionarily, they talk about the fact that the peacock, it's, I'm making a weird analogy, but that the peacock, the part of what's happening is that having all of those feathers actually works against their survival.
Mm.
And so because they have this huge display and they're still healthy, it proves how super healthy they are. And that is why they get to mate and those traits move forward. Okay. The fact that Jean-Claude Van Damme, while throwing what I would call a jumping spinning wheel kick, can throw his other leg in the opposite directions, hold the splits while spinning in air, is the most ridiculous waste of energy anyone could possibly do. But the fact that he can pull it off shows just how awesome he is. And as a person who spent probably 2 or 3 years trying to throw that kick without throwing the other kick into, you know, into the splits, It is really, really damn impressive. And I'll also say I spent many, many years trying to get to the splits, and I never, ever got there, despite all of the torturous things my sensei did to me, including including attaching my legs to ropes, forcing them apart, putting them on towels on slick wooden floors so they'd slide apart, putting me upside down and pushing down on, never got to the splits, had so much pain that like the world went white multiple times, but I never got there. And so every time I would see Jean-Claude Van Damme, whether he's being stretched apart on the tree in Kickbox or whatever, it was always like, dude, that is. And it's funny too, because it's, you know, he has ballet training, and like the splits are a thing that I think we think of, particularly in the 80s in a more sexist era, was like, well, that was a feminine thing to do.
Right.
Guys weren't supposed to be flexible. And right. Jean-Claude Van Damme made those splits the most manly thing that any human could do in, you know, 1989 or 90, you know?
Yeah, and you bring up Arnold. I think it's a great connection to make, because A, he was originally going to be the Predator. And then he complained about being in the costume, complained about the heat. And they replaced him with the person who became the Predator. And so, which we talked about when we've talked about Predator before. And so there were connections with Arnold. He had been Chuck Norris's bouncer at Chuck Norris's club that he owned back in the 80s. And this is a guy who worked hard to get noticed. Like, he worked hard. He would go to clubs to try that he knew producers were at, or that he hoping to see a movie star. He went armed with his karate magazines, which had focused on him. And we'll get to why in just a second. He went with his headshot. He was a hustler. He believed in himself, and he went and put himself out on the line. So many people are afraid to walk out there on the tightrope because they're afraid to handle rejection. Jean-Claude at that age was going out there and, you know, risking ridicule, risking being made fun of, probably multiple times was laughed at or laughed out of a meeting. But he did that multiple times to try to get to this dream that he'd had since he was 13 years old, which was to go to America and become a star. Very similar to Arnold, right? In a different way, Arnold had won the Olympia. He'd had all these things. Now, Jean-Claude had won these karate tournaments and had been part of these massive achievements. But it had not transferred over in the way. There was no pumping iron for what he did to kind of lay the groundwork a little bit. And so the fact that Arnold starts to move away from the action films in the late 80s that's where Van Damme also kind of slides in to fill that need as well, to do these films. Because he had about a 7-year run here, Steve. When you go from Bloodsport to about the end here with Maximum Risk, that's a 7-year run here where he is, or 8-year run rather, where he is like putting out movies at a hell of a clip to try to get people to enjoy his stuff. And overall, he is responsible for $1 billion of box office at the movies, with the movies that he's done. And a lot of these movies, Steve, as you said, they're not made for much money. Bloodsport was made for like $15-20 million, and it made so much money. So a lot of his films, the reason he had cachet in Hollywood for a little while was because his films could be made for on the cheap, and they would make a lot of money worldwide for him and for the producers there in the studio. So it's incredible to think about what he was able to accomplish in such a short amount of time once the dam broke for him, you know.
I think you make a great point. And again, I just keep going, you know, and it's an ongoing topic on the Cinephiles, and it will continue to be an ongoing topic of the state of cinema today, the state of movie theaters today. You know, we're constantly talking about all of these massive, huge movies that are not doing, you know, they're underperforming the box office.
Right.
And I think what's so interesting about it is that, again, it is this weird transition that has happened in the last 30 or 40 years, where what had been the B and C pictures have become the A pictures, and that the most expensive movies are now the action movies.
Right.
And that wasn't the case. Obviously we talk about Total Recall, which is 1990, is a huge, one of the most expensive movies ever made. Terminator 2 is as well.
Yeah.
But there was a normal thing to make $1, $2, or $3 million or $4 million action movies.
Yeah.
You know, like these, and they could go to the theater, and people would go to the theater. I think, you know, I think Bloodsport was like $3 million and made $30 million or something.
Yeah.
And we're not making those things anymore. And so again, I go, you know, we're keep trying to solve the box office problem today. Yeah. And it seems to be that what they're doing, and I'm not saying that the studios are wrong, is we need big IP, huge spectacle, spend a ton of money. Yeah. Spend a ton of money on advertising and hope that we have a $1 billion movie. And if we don't have a $1 billion movie, it's a flop, you know?
Yeah.
And I go like, man, would people go to see A dumb, fun action movie with a good martial artist in the lead that costs $3 million or $4 million or $5 million to make, and maybe it makes 20. Yeah. And then that's a hit. You know, it's just what the American Fiction guy was saying at the Oscars of like, maybe take your $200 million and make 10, $20 million bets, or make 40 $10 million bets, you know, and we'll get it in a different place, you know?
Yeah, certainly you see that with how people crowed about The Creator only being $80 million and the special effects there was something you would expect from a $200 million movie.
Right.
And Godzilla Minus One being made for a little amount of money that got made in The Incredible. And I know you've got a different work hours, different work requirements, different pay, that kind of stuff. But still, it is possible for lesser money to make these. And I think the horror genre, in a way, has replaced these action movies from the 80s, because you see a lot of these horror movies come out that are made for $5, $10, $15, $20 million, and they make $100, $200, $300 million. Of course, Blair Witch being the most famous, but you see it nowadays too. There's so many horror films that come out made for the cheap, and then they make a crap ton of money at the box office because people want to be scared out of their minds. And back then, we wanted to be entertained. And I think there is still that void, Steve. We see now the return of what I would call macho cinema nowadays with Frank Grillo, John Bernthal, even the late Lena's years now, Mel Gibson, Liam Neeson stuff. These are more macho films that echo the stuff from the 1980s. None of them are muscular. Well, I mean, Frank works out certainly in a great shape, but like none of these are these kinds of films that we remember that are these larger than life type films in terms of action movies. But that idea of the macho-ness that we loved from those films, I think, is in a way reflected in some of the macho. Gerard Butler certainly has made a whole cottage industry for himself out of doing those kinds of films nowadays. So we see that happening. Yeah. I want to go back in time to give you guys a little bit of background on Jean-Claude Van Damme. And for those you may not know, he is born Jean-Claude Camille Francois Van Varenberg. That's his actual name. French and Dutch descent, born in October 18th of 1960 in Brussels. He was brought up Roman Catholic, but his paternal grandmother was Jewish. His dad was an accountant. His mom was a florist. And it's his dad who enrolled him in Shotokan karate school at age 10. And then at 12, he went and joined the Centre National de Karaté under the guidance of Claude Goetz in Belgium. He trained for 4 years and earned a spot on the Belgian karate team. And then he trained full contact karate and kickboxing with the legend Dominique Valera. And then, according to Van Damme, he said, "It was a tough growing up for me because I was a geek kid. And physically, I was not gifted. I was a scrawny kid who got beat up all the time. And so for me, it was very difficult getting into martial arts and being good at martial arts because it was just, I wasn't physically gifted. So I had to work harder than other people to achieve it." At the age of 15, he starts his competitive karate career in Belgium. From 1976 to 1980, he compiles a record of 44 victories and 4 defeats in tournament and non-tournament semi-contact matches. He was a member of the Belgium karate team that won the European Karate Championship on December 26th of 1979. He placed second at the Challenge Coupe d'Espoir karate tournament there and defeated 25 opponents before losing to his teammate in the final. And then in 1980, he competed against his former teammate on an undercard of essentially was an early MMA type approach to these kinds of things and had that part of it as well. In order to fund himself, he opened a gym in Brussels, and it was successful. It was called the California Gym, and in a California State Gym. And in essence, he was making at the peak $15,000 a month, the gym was making at the time. And that's what he used, selling the gym, selling all of his stuff. That's what he used to fund his attempts to become an actor in America in 1982. His father was totally against it. That you're living a great life. You got a beautiful car, beautiful business. Why are you leaving? But he had a dream to go to America. He'd been profiled in Karate Magazine for what he had accomplished, and he essentially used that as a calling card. And as Steve said, when he got to America, he didn't know English at all, had to suffer with, he was delivering pizza, doing odd jobs, as I said, working as a bouncer for Chuck Norris, trying to get on these movies, being stunt guys on these movies, these kinds of things. And eventually, all that money started running out that he had, and it was all, he was living out of his car. He was stealing food to eat. He was sleeping on his friends' couches. And it was Bloodsport that finally broke for him. And the way he got it was doing a roundhouse kick at a restaurant that he was the waiter at for the producer of Bloodsport. And he had been listed. He had told them that he was in Predator with Schwarzenegger, and it was before they had removed him from the cast list when he initially was a monster. And that's how he got the lead in Bloodsport. They thought they were getting like a main character from Predator onto their film to be the star of Bloodsport. So
nice.
You got to use what you can use to get into a position to become famous in Hollywood, because Hollywood is full of people that lie to you. So you might as well lie to get in, for God's sake. So, yeah.
It's just such a story. It's so funny. I hadn't really thought until we were just having this conversation about the comparison with Arnold. But
yeah,
while Van Damme wasn't at the top of his sport like Arnold was, he still was a serious competitor.
Yes.
The real thing. It wasn't a fake thing. And just the scrappy, determined, I'm going to make this happen, even if nobody believes with me thing.
Yeah.
Man, I've seen this, people saying this in the comments. That's what's necessary to make it in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I never occurred to me to throw a roundhouse kick at a producer. Maybe if I had done that, maybe my career would have gone a different way. I don't know.
He didn't ask you to do the splits right afterwards, but yeah.
Oh, damn it. I can't do the splits. I never got the splits.
I tried for many, many years. Another element of this that I think is important, you hit it on real quick, Steve, was the ballet training. He did 5 years of ballet training combined with lifting weights to change his body and be able to pull off the move you're talking about, the split kick move that he became famous for. And another element of this that I think is phenomenal to think about is that he influenced the creation of Johnny Cage in the Mortal Kombat game. It was based on him. They wanted to get Van Damme, but he couldn't do it because he was signed to Sega Genesis for another game that had been in production. So the creators of Mortal Kombat just, in essence, created Johnny Cage as an homage to his the Frank Dux character from Bloodsport. And that's why they made his finishing move, the split punch into the groin, as an homage to Bloodsport. So it's amazing how many tentacles that Van Damme has in the industry in so many different and interesting ways, man.
Well, he was a big deal. I mean, this is it's hard to remember. And it's funny too, because you're right. It's exact same time as Steven Seagal. And as a guy, you know, even though at the time it came out, I was doing martial arts more like, you know, karate and the kicks and things like that. The martial art I did for the most, 20 years is Aikido, which is Steven Seagal's martial art. And it's so funny thinking about, we've had so many Arnold versus Sly comparisons.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of Seagal versus Van Damme comparisons.
100%.
And I will say, and anyone can argue with me who wants, you say Van Damme is the real deal. Seagal is definitely the real deal. Without question, he's an Aikido guy. Watching him back in the day, that dude is amazing. Now, I have a lot of issues with Seagal for a lot of reasons. But he was a very specific style of Aikido. Yeah. And it's interesting to see like the arrogance and where Seagal's career takes him and how people feel about him in the long run, as opposed to Van Damme. And I think we have this really warm feeling for this guy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not that, you know, nobody's career in Hollywood is going to last forever, and his doesn't last forever. And he made a lot of movies that, you know, aren't good.
Yeah.
But we still, and I think in particular, I know we're going to get there. There are things that happen later on in his career that bring in just tremendous love, you know, for that guy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you look at how he started out. He started out like a hungry kid once he got Bloodsport. I mean, Steve, there is no logical reason to act like it's the 1920s and you got to do 40 films a year. He was doing like 4 films a year. It was insane how many films he was putting out here to try to stay in the public domain. And there were only occasional ones that are legitimately like damn good films, like Time Cop and Bloodsport, of course, which a lot of people love. Even Universal Soldier, to a degree, people enjoy and want to defend as a damn good movie. But you look at the connections he's met, as I said, his tentacles, like John Woo, his first American film, Van Damme is his star. Ringo Lam, his first American film, Van Damme is his star. So he's Hark, his first American film, Van Damme is his star. So in a way, he has been kind of an entry point for these people who are very revered in Asian action cinema to come to the States and feel safe using someone who understands them and understands the training of martial artists and is willing to give of himself in order to help them become successful. Do they lead to great films? I would argue no, mostly.
No.
But the fact that he had that kind of respect from them, I think speaks volumes to how people felt about this guy.
I so wish that, because what happened, you know, when these filmmakers came to the U.S. and John Woo, I know a lot of the stories around Hard Target, which, by the way, friend of the cinephiles, Stephen B. Jones, loves Hard Target still to this day, continues to quote it.
That's got to be a rewatch down the road for us, man.
I haven't watched it in a long time. I did rewatch a couple of Van Damme movies to prepare for this. Yeah. I did not rewatch that one. But it's just this weird thing of you have this filmmaker like John Woo, top of his game in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Then he comes to the United States, and under the way the system works in the United States, he can't make the kind of movie that he wants to make. And Van Damme, I'm sure, watched those incredible movies, John Woo movies from the Hong Kong era, and goes, oh, I want to make a movie with this guy. Yeah. And it's funny. Like, do we get a couple of doves? Yeah, we get that. Do we get a couple of slow motion moments in it? Yes, we totally do. Can you kind of see a little bit of John Woo? Yes. Is it a good movie? It's, you know, it is what it is. Well, and this is why I really think the sliding scale is so important, which is that you have to go, I'm not comparing this to The Godfather or Jaws Die Hard. I'm saying, did I get out of it what I wanted to get out of it? And for me, particularly in this era, if the fight scenes were good, I was happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Let's go through this era. As we said, Bloodsport starts things off in 1988. Then we go to Cyborg in 1989, which he chose to do. He was given the choice of three different films. He went with Cyborg. Kickboxer was the next film, which I thoroughly love as a guilty pleasure. Lionheart, these are insane. That's an insane film. And I just remember the guy who was training him, the black actor, Lionheart, just yelling throughout the movie. Death Warrant is the next one. Double Impact, where he has now achieved the status where he can act opposite himself in a movie. Steve, you know, that's a certain level of status that you can achieve when you're acting opposite yourself. They think you can actually play two different characters who are twins separated at birth, avenging the death of their parents. Then we get Universal Soldier, arguably his first leveling up film here, him and Dolph Lundgren. This one directed by Roland Emmerich and telling a bigger story with a larger budget. Then we get Nowhere to Run with Patricia Arquette. And as you mentioned, Hard Target with John Woo. And then Time Cop, which people would argue is probably the greatest film of his from this time. Street Fighter after that. Sudden Death. The Quest, which is his directorial debut. Van Damme directed that movie. And then Maximum Risk, which is about the beginning of the end there with Natasha Henstridge. So there's a lot of fun, guilty pleasure movies, one damn good movie in that mix. And I think that's so much fun to consider this run of movies that he went on here. And remember, look, I'm not comparing it to the Beatles, but the Beatles only lasted, once they got famous, like 8 or 9 years, 7 years. Look at this run of films here. It's a pretty good run overall for a martial artist.
I think your comparison with the Beatles in terms of the time of his peak is 100% accurate. After that, I'm going to say the comparison falls down a bit.
I agree with you, yes.
But let's address some of this. And it's funny, too, because I think about this in terms of me as a consumer of martial arts films.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so 88 is when Bloodsport comes out. 88 is also right around when I move into the apartment with my friend Jeff, and that's when my serious martial arts training starts, is in 1988. Gotcha. And so the other thing that happens is this is also when we're starting to scour every video store we can find for like these little known Hong Kong films.
Right.
Because I had seen a little bit of Jackie Chan. I don't think I had seen Jet Li yet, like right maybe 87, 88. But by 89 or 90, I was obsessively looking for the Hong Kong movies. And so there's this weird thing of like discovering Van Damme. And now we have like an American style action movie star, when my understanding about martial arts is growing. And so like then Kickboxer, we rented it over and over and over and over again. Kickboxer is one of the ones I rewatched a couple of weeks ago. So here's the thing. It is so dumb.
Yeah.
And there were just certain parts where I just kind of had to fast forward, because when we were starting, I was like, wait, this is the plot. And this is, and so his brother almost gets killed by this guy. And like the whole way it's all set up is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I don't think anybody blocks a punch in like the whole movie. And this is the thing that I started to discover, because right at this moment, as I'm starting to get into Jackie Chan,
yeah,
and the comparison between Jet Li and Jackie Chan and Hong Kong martial arts choreography,
yeah,
and Van Damme choreography, there's just no comparison.
Yeah.
That being said, he moves so great and he's so charming that you just root for him.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I haven't seen Lionheart for a long time. I have the same memory as you of the guy yelling Lionheart. When you get it, Double Impact is like, well, Jackie Chan made Twins, which is his version of this. And Twins, the fight scene's off the charts better than anything that you see. And frankly, look, I think Jean-Claude Van Damme is, when we get to, you know, JCVD, like that, there's some incredible acting that he does. But him playing Twins and Double Impact, not so much for me. You know, things like Universal Soldier were painful.
Wow. How dare you? What?
I found it that way.
And I
absolutely 100% agree that Time Cop is the movie that is like, oh, we might be able to consider this a good movie. You know, because it is, it's an interesting, it is, you know, it's not exactly at the level of the great time travel movies of all time, but Time Cop totally works. You know,
it's directed by Peter Hyams, who did one of my closet favorite 1980 movies in Running Scared with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal. He directed the sequel to 2001, 2010, The Year We Made Contact, the fantastic Star Chamber with Michael Douglas, which not enough people have seen. Capricorn One, which is a closet favorite of a lot of people. The Monster Squad, The Presidio, Stay Tuned, which is that funny John Ritter movie. Then he does Time Cop and Sudden Death kind of back to back. And then it's a law of diminishing returns until he ends up doing Universal Soldier Regeneration in 2009. So, but like at the time, this is a director who actually has some cachet working with Van Damme here to bring about this film, Time Cop. And Mia Sara, it's the first thing that I remember Mia Sara being in that I watched since Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh,
being his wife. And then the great Ron Silver playing the villain in this. So you upped the level of actor that was involved in the film here by bringing him onto this. And I think this was their attempt to maybe move him into another realm as an actor and see if you could go the Bruce Willis route. And try to do things that are a little bit more serious and with some commentary attached to it. So, yeah, I've always appreciated Time Cop for that, for sure.
No, Time Cop totally works as a movie. It was another one I watched. Ron Silver, by the way, is ridiculously perfectly over the top.
Yes,
he in the whole thing. Always,
so great.
Yeah, he's great. And the, you know, like, well, this is the thing, is that do I have genuine emotion watching Bloodsport? Not particularly. Right. I mean, I love, by the way, one thing we haven't mentioned about Bloodsport is it brings back Bruce Lee's villain of Bolo Young to be the bad guy. And he is one of the great martial arts bad guys of all time.
Yeah.
And even more so, like the potential that you see of him in Enter the Dragon, he pays off totally in Bloodsport.
Yeah.
And the other thing, and again, I just to jump back to Bloodsport, because we hadn't mentioned before, one of the other great things about the tournament style of the martial arts film is you get to see the guy with the monkey style, and you get to see the guy with drunken style, and you get to see the guy who's doing capoeira, and you get to see, which as a martial arts fan was always so fun to watch how these different styles match up together. And you see him revisit that several times in other of his films where we're exploring these different styles. But to get back to Time Cop, I mean, it's like, it's really hard. The thing about being this kind of martial arts action character is it's really hard to escape it. You know, because people, you got to do the splits. You're going to do the split kick. They want to get the same, you know, they want the same thing, you know, but different. Mm-hmm. And Time Cop is the one where I think it really delivers on all of it.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's sad that that's kind of, you know, really the end, you know.
Yeah.
Because you get things like Street Fighter and, you know, there's just so many things you're like, oh, that's not, not so
good. And then the one with Dennis Rodman, which really you're like, oh, hey, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? But, you know, the man had to work, and this is I do want to stay a little bit longer here because I want to make sure, as you said with Bloodsport, it's really important to remember that film is an absolute time capsule. And as Steve said, it was made, as I looked it up here, it was made for like $2.5 million. It made $50 million. That's a hell of a return on a $2.5 million film, production wise. And you've got Forrest Whitaker,
You've got, I think it's Donald Gibb, the guy who played Ogre in the Revenge of the Nerds movies. So you've got some good, decent actors in this movie. And I think this movie influences the MMA explosion that is to come in the late 90s. This idea, it's, as you just highlighted, the fact that people are watching this movie at the numbers that they did, and 50, you got to think about 50 million back then, not 50 million now, when tickets were like $4 or $6 to go see a movie. That's a lot of people going to see your movie. I can't help but think that influenced people, that whole showing the different types of martial arts for people to be excited to see more of that. And then the MMA explosion is just a few years later. So there's a lot of influences here with his stuff that I think is important to remember with him. He's just such a fascinating guy in that way. And I just don't want to go past any of that without making sure we give him his flowers for that kind of stuff. Yeah,
totally agree. And you make such a good point, because like, if you hung out with martial arts people pre-MMA, you would always get the discussion of which martial art is the best. And people would say, oh, totally. Wing Chun is better for this. And no, you need to have, you know, Eskrima for in close fighting, or it's this for that. Right, yeah. And we'd have these arguments. And of course, everyone basically thinks that whatever martial art they do is the best. Yeah. And so this kind of movie, A, plays with that. And then along comes MMA, which says very clearly, in the circumstances of one-on-one combat with those rules, it's very clear what actually is useful.
Exactly. Like,
as much as I love Aikido, you don't see Aikido guys going into the octagon, because that martial art is not set up for that. Nobody's doing wushu, or you know, like, it's not that those aren't beautiful, amazing martial artists. They are, and I love them, but it's very clear that striking, ground game, jujitsu, wrestling, These are the martial arts that you have to be familiar with if you're going to get into that octagon. You know, answered some of those questions.
And I want to run through the box office so people understand. We're going to talk Bloodsport. Cyborg, less than $500,000. That's how much the production was. Less than $500,000. It made $10.2 million. Kickboxer here was made for $2.7 million. It made $50 million. Death Warrant. Made for $6 million. That's your prison movie. You got to have the prison action film. Like Stallone with Lock Up, you got to have the prison action film. Later, Escape Plan with Schwarzenegger and Stallone. $6 million, the budget, $46.7 million is how much that film made. Double Impact made for $15 million. It made $30 million. Universal, $23 million. It made $95 million worldwide. Nowhere to Run with Patricia or Roseanne Arquette. Made for $15 million, made $64 million.
Wow.
Hard Target made for $19 million. It made $75 million. Time Cop, I got to hit that one correctly. Oh, never mind, I'll skip it. Street Fighter, $35 million. It made $100 million. Sudden Death, as I bring it up, $35 million. It made $65 million. The Quest, which is the one he directed, that's when things started to fall apart. It only made $57 million. Overall as a film. And so those are the things we got to look at. And Time Cop was made for $27 million, made $102 million. So you could argue that he was one of the most bankable stars in the late 1980s into the 1990s, because his films made money all the way until Maximum Risk and things started to fall apart for him. So it's an incredible run, Steve. Whatever the quality of these films, and you can argue quality because that's subjective all day long, financially, he was box office gold for these producers in all of these films.
I don't think quality is just subjective. I think there are qualities that we can point to that are less good about some of these films.
Sure. Like, fair.
Yeah. I mean, but again, it's why are we going to the movies? And this is, I keep thinking about this idea of today and people not going to the movie theaters because we wanted to go to the movie theater on a Friday night with our buddies to watch Jean-Claude Van Damme kick some ass.
Yep. Yep.
And I knew then these weren't great movies. That's not the point, but they were great at being what I wanted them to be.
Right.
You know,
because his charm and his personality combined with the action sequences and the choreographed fights, that was the right combination. And you had always had an attractive woman, whether she was the villain or she was his love interest in the movie. It was always important to have that element in the film. But I think at the end of the day, there was something about him. And as I did more research for this show today, it occurred to me that there was always something instinctively that you liked about him. And I think that's the same thing with Bruce Lee. There's something instinctively that you liked about him. He had that underdog status with the ability to be the champion by the end of the movie. And that's a rarity when you look at martial arts movies. Jackie has some of that, right? That feeling of like, oh, he looks overmatched. He looks, it looks like, oh, he's they're come, everything's turning against him. Is he going to be able to do it? And that suspension of belief, when you look at these movies, I think is essential for why they're successful. He is still that scrawny kid who was getting beat up all the time. And it comes through in his performances because that's something you never lose. And I think we instinctively, subconsciously, those of us who have been bullied or know why we got into martial arts or why we learned to fight or lift weights, we gravitate to people who radiate that instinctually on some level, I believe.
I think this is a great topic. I would love to spend a moment on this because I think you've introduced something really interesting, which is that I think for all of these people, there's an essence.
Yes.
And that essence comes across on the screen. And when the movie fits that essence, it works really well. So Bruce Lee, first of all, super cool. Like there is, you know, like he puts out that sort of energy, but he manages in a couple of his movies, like in Return of the Dragon, to be able to put some insecurity on that as well. That's interesting. But like Bruce Lee, like this is a dangerous dude. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like as soon as he starts to fight, he is the best person there. Yeah. Jackie Chan's the underdog. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Jackie Chan is a goofball. He's always overmatched. He's always in situations he doesn't understand. He's never, because what he had to do, because he was one of the Bruce Lee imitators that people are trying to turn him into the next Bruce Lee. Yeah. And it didn't work because you had to figure out who Jackie was. Well, Jackie is a comedian and he's a goofball. And he's the rambunctious, misbehaving kid who needs to learn a lesson. That's who he is. Whereas when you go to Chuck Norris, it's like Chuck Norris is a different thing. Chuck Norris isn't. He's not like Bruce Lee is cool like James Dean is cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Chuck Norris is not cool like that. Chuck Norris is tough.
Yes.
Chuck Norris is American, silent, tough guy who's, you know, who's got this other energy.
He's like Gary Cooper. He's a Western star in that way. Yes. Yeah. Whereas Jackie's more Charlie Chaplin and
exactly.
Great point.
And I think you're so right. Is Jean-Claude Van Damme is always the new person when in the good movie. He's always like, that's what Bloodsport is. That's what Kickboxer is. Yeah. He's always in a new situation. Time Cop isn't exactly that because Time Cop, he kind of was that at the beginning. And then his wife gets killed or whatever. And then he's this hard, tough person. Yeah. But like and I think it's magically finding the quality of the film that matches the character of the star.
Yeah.
And that's also the difference between stars and actors is that a star, they are who they are. Like, and Arnold is who Arnold is. He has a range, but he's never not going to be Arnold.
Yeah.
Whereas Sylvester Stallone is an actor, you know?
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? And so Rambo and Rocky, they're very, very different. They fit qualities that are within Sylvester Stallone, but they are still very, very different characters.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at this situation because we talk about Stallone all the time, like, oh, you were able to create multiple franchises with Rambo and with Rocky, right? And now Expendables, right? Van Damme was doing that in the 80s as well. I mean, you look at all these films that have spawned sequels to the stuff that's gone down here. No Retreat, No Surrender has a sequel here. There are a number of Kickboxer sequels as well. There are a number of Universal Soldier sequels. He has got multiple films where they have been sequels to each of them that have made him a lot of money as a producer on all of these things. Even though he didn't appear with them again, there were numerous Bloodsport sequels as well. So there are a number. And Street Fighter had a number of sequels. Time Cop even had a sequel and a TV series. And there was even a prequel called Welcome to Sudden Death, which is the one with Powers Booth, where he's a security guard at the Pittsburgh Penguins hockey arena. This guy with the French accent is the security guard, or the head fire department guy there. So it's fascinating. So you think about, he rolled out multiple franchises. That's how strong his star power was, that his first installment of these movies influenced these producers to create multiple sequels to these movies because he put his name on that brand, and that brand they were able to take and go places with it and cast other people in these films and still make some money. So it's a fascinating thing because, it's not Rambo. It's not a Terminator. It's not these kinds of things at that level. But it's an incredible machine that he was able to churn out and create brand awareness for multiple titles of his that spawned all these sequels.
Well, they're so, I mean, high concept movies like Bloodsport and Kickboxer, it's like, okay, we need another Bloodsport movie. Okay, it's set around a tournament. There's going to be a bad guy. We're going to meet some characters. One or two of them are going to die. It's pretty easy to just plug in a new bunch of people and just like, okay, this time we have a boxer. This time we have an MMA guy. This time we have, you know, a Green Beret. And we just like put those people, plug them into the system. And then, you know, you keep going. Yeah. Like, that's the nice thing about these high concept things. And honestly, when you make a $3 million movie or whatever, you say $1.5 million and it makes $50 million, you got a lot of cash in your pocket and you own the name Bloodsport or Kickboxer or Time Cop. And you're like, let's go to the races. You know,
I don't have to be in it, but I'll make money off it as a producer. And that's what he eventually became with these movies, is he realized, hey, I've got to take control of my career. Making myself a producer on these movies is a way to watch the money and make sure the money isn't going into other places. I think he spoke about one of these films. I don't know if it was Double Impact or which one of these films right around that run, either Double Impact or Death Warrant or Nowhere to Run. The money that the producer was making off that movie, he was using money that was meant for the movie, and he was funneling it to the Stone Cold movie with Brian Bosworth. And so when he found out about that, Van Damme said he threatened the guy and he threw one of these fruits at the wall, and it was a mango or something, trying to hit the producer in the head. And the producer ducked, but he never fucked him out of the money again. So, you know, these are these things that you have to do, unfortunately, because when you're dealing with action films, brother, and especially at this level, there's not a lot of savory people who you're going to be dealing with most of the time. These are people who think these action movie stars are lunkheads and they can take advantage of them and lock them into contracts and take a majority of the money. Kind of like we saw with the music industry. We found out about it all through the 50s and 60s, what they did to a lot of artists, usually black, in screwing them over and making their money. So you saw that. So he was a guy who wanted to be part of all the pieces. He was a writer on a majority of these. He ended up becoming a director on a few of these. And so these kind of like Stallone, right? Following that same path. You know, Schwarzenegger never had any interest in that kind of stuff. Yes, was he a producer on some of these films? Sure. But I don't think he was ever like an active producer. And I think Van Damme is a nice mixture of both Schwarzenegger and Stallone in how he approached this action, these action movies, so to speak, you know.
I don't know what industry would be the most horrible to examine 25 years of their accounting practices. Because there are a lot of terrible ones. You mentioned the music industry, of course, there's all sorts of unions and construction issues and mafia ties to whatnot. But the film industry is fucked up. Yeah. I mean, let's just be real clear. And it certainly, if you look at people that are cranking out horror movie after horror movie, low budget horror movie after horror movie, they're doing the same thing. Yeah. They're totally funneling money from one budget to another budget. And the way accounting, as you know, my ex was a film production accountant for a decade, working on movies that were very on the up and up. It's not that they were doing illegal things, but moving money around in a budget all the time and calling this thing, and then it becomes that thing to save a little money to pay off something else. That's how movies are made, you know?
Yeah. Good point. All right, well, let's take a quick break, Steve, so we can put in some commercials in the audio version of this show here. When we come back, we'll talk about the latter half of Van Damme's career and then answer some of you all's Streamlabs and Super Chats here. You see the Streamlabs address right above Steve and I's heads there in the middle. If you want to send in your questions, thoughts, and comments about Van Damme, or if you want to send in Super Chats, we will answer them here after the break. And we'll be right back right after this. All right, Steve, I want to get us into the latter half of Van Damme's career, but I do also want to say something. You mentioned earlier about Steven Seagal, and you're one of the few people who I've ever heard say Seagal could probably go toe-to-toe with Van Damme and be effective. There are two stories, one from Stallone and one not from Stallone, where Van Damme challenged Steven Seagal to a fight at Sylvester Stallone's home at a party. And Seagal snuck out the back door and never had the fight. A second time was at a club, and apparently he challenged him at a nightclub to a fight to prove, because he had heard that Seagal was talking shit about him all around Hollywood. And apparently, this is the quote from someone who was there, Seagal disappeared like Houdini out the back door. So we never got this fight that maybe we'd wanted to see. Maybe it was a Apollo Rocky fight at the bottom of some gym in the middle of nowhere. And no one saw it but them, and no one but those two know the answer of who would beat who. But I think it's fascinating to hear that Seagal was the one who was like,
yeah, I'm not going to do this. And maybe it's because he felt like I'm going to really injure this guy and I don't want to do that. Or maybe he just, like to talk that shit and not back it up. I don't know, but it's fascinating.
So I have no opinion on whether or not this happened and if Seagal snuck out the back and why he might have done it.
Yeah.
But, and there's much more footage of Seagal doing martial arts outside of movies than there is footage that I've seen of Van Damme.
You're right.
I think there's like two little videos of him in tournaments that you can find from the late 70s of Van Damme. And he looks like to me a lot of pretty good Taekwondo karate guys, but I can't assess very much from that. If you go back, there's a lot of video of Seagal, both from like the 70s and even up to today. And there's even video of it. Like if you look for the Seagal Merv Griffin video, I highly recommend it. There's of the stuff where he's a movie star, where he's just a martial arts guy doing demonstrations. Also, by the way, his Uke is the guy who's your partner who you throw around. His Uke, who's this much smaller guy, one of the greatest Ukes I've ever seen. And the shit that Seagal does to him is completely freaking brutal. And the efficiency and the speed of Seagal as a guy who's done a lot of Aikido. And by the way, Aikido is the gentle martial art. That's why I love it. It is about nonviolence and not hurting people, for my philosophy. That ain't how Seagal does it.
No,
Seagal is absolutely fucking brutal. The throws he puts people into, the stuff he puts people through is rough. And I've watched a ton of footage of Seagal doing demonstrations, even up to recent stuff where you've seen him. I know there's one, I think it was George St. Pierre with MMA guys where he's doing stuff and they're showing him respect.
So
like I look and again, let's go back to the statement I made earlier. Aikido guys do not go into the octagon to fight MMA. It is not a martial art that's set up for that. So does that mean that I'm saying that I'm certain that Seagal could take out Van Damme in a fight? I don't know that. And Aikido is a defensive martial art. And Jean-Claude Van Damme is a very good martial artist. But in terms of Aikido guys, I have to say, I will say it again, Seagal is the real deal.
Well, and listen, from what you've described, and I've seen some videos too, including recently when he's doing that stuff for Putin or whatever. It's scary to watch how quickly he can move, even at this advanced age, with all this weight that he's put on since he was a superstar. The hand movements are truly chilling at how quickly he can move and effectively throw people from one side to the other. So you might be right that he could pose a stronger threat than a normal Aikido person would do because of what you just said, in that he does it with a bit more of an offensive mindset than a defensive mindset, which could be really interesting when matched up with the split kicker and Van Damme.
Yeah. And when he get those, having been in those joint locks and knowing what they are and how they feel, I can see what's happening. And they are on. And this is one of the really good Aikido people. There's no time distance between contact and when the joint lock is applied. And when so this is the thing, is when you see him, because some of these like Sankyo and stuff, they're hard to get. Like Sankyo, to me, I won't go into details of what it means. It's a three-joint lock. For me, it was always like, when I was teaching, it's like, look, give this 3 years before you're going to even be able to do this at all.
Wow.
And, because it's just really hard to get it in the exact right spot. And Seagal's like, it's like that. It's on. And you could see the reaction of the Uke just going like, because it's freaking on. And I can tell that that's not bullshit.
For the love of God. So as Van Damme is becoming successful and making the money, we're going to the latter half of his career. There's some negative things that come across for him. He becomes, he develops a cocaine habit on which he spent up to $10,000 a week. According to him, consuming up to 10 grams of cocaine per day by 1996. He was arrested for driving under the influence in 1999. There were multiple attempts at drug rehabilitation that were just unsuccessful. And then he resorted to resolve his addiction via quitting it cold turkey and exercise. But in 1998, this is what actually helped him. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And he discussed this on the British reality show that he was on called Behind Closed Doors. He said, sometimes you're going to like me and sometimes you're not, and you're going to hate me sometimes, but what can I do? I'm not perfect. I'm an extreme bipolar and I'm taking medication for this. When I was young, I was suffering from those swing moods. In the morning, the sky was blue when I was going to school. And to me, the sky was black. I was so sad. And so that was something that kind of, I think the reason he was self-medicate, or he was using the drugs, was in essence self-medicate from the bipolar disorder, because I imagine this is something that was affecting people in his life. He's been married 5 times to 4 different women, twice to Gladys Portuguese, who's a Portuguese, who's a bodybuilder. They've had 2 children. He had an affair with actress Darcy LaPierre, who he later married, and she had one of his kids. After they divorced, she went on and married the one of the creators of Herbalife and was his wife until he died. And then she went into barrel rodeo riding. So a fascinating thing with Darcy LaPierre there. He had an affair with Kylie Minogue, reportedly, on the set of Street Fighter, which he was married to Darcy at the time. She found out about when he admitted it. And as he's gotten older, there have been some weirder things. Like, he claimed that the Illuminati, including the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, were trying to stop Donald Trump from winning back in 2016. And all of these things that happened with him. But amidst all of that, he has come back multiple times. He was on Friends for a 2-episode arc. He came back to play the villain in Expendables. He was originally going to be the Dolph Lundgren character in Expendables. Didn't like doing that, so they brought him back to be the villain in the second one, which made a lot of money here. He did this campaign with Volvo where he redid his split, Steve, across 2 18-wheelers, which I thought was a fantastic commercial, which was apparently seen by 35 million views within 2 days for this commercial, which was
incredible. That thing's amazing. I so remember when it came out, and it also, I mean, this talk about it, just a revitalization moment.
Yeah.
Is that it's like he'd been through a lot of stuff, as you've just described. He's you know, hasn't had a big movie in a while, and then he comes out and does this ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I love this guy again. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He's always found his way. But I think the number one thing that kind of signaled a change in people's affection for him or interpretation of him was the performance in JCVD. We've mentioned this, we've referenced this, we've talked about it, Steve, in other shows every once in a while, on live shows or doing shorts. I rewatched that six minute monologue that he does near the end of the movie, where he, in essence, you see not only Van Damme the person with all the walls down, you see Van Damme the actor. And Time Magazine said this is the second greatest performance of the year in 2008, and felt that he should have been nominated for an Oscar. Time Magazine, for God's sakes. And that tells you there was so much pain and hurt and amazing vulnerability in that monologue. If you guys have not seen JCVD, it's a goddamn great movie.
Yeah, it is.
That monologue elevates it into legend status, where you see Van Damme stripped bare in essence, a black and white type of situation, filtered to what it looks almost like black and white, telling you in his entire story and what he went through. And it's so honest and amazing, Steve. When I finished watching it today, I was like, I actually want to go through a frame by frame breakdown of this one day for maybe one of the videos on my channel. But it's an amazing thing. What are your memories? What are your recollections? What are your thoughts of Van Damme at the later time and then in JCVD?
So first of all, I rewatched it a half an hour ago, I guess it's an hour ago now.
Yeah.
I rewatched that monologue again. I agree with everything you said. I think it is. I remember seeing the trailers for JCVD when it was coming out and just going like, what the hell is this? What is he doing? And because it's such a Charlie Kaufman kind of Nicolas Cage, you know, there's the, you know, of like, okay, you're going to, or, you know, it's being John Malkovich. It's like, okay, you're playing yourself in a movie,
right?
And yet what he ends up doing, it's this complete deconstruction of his image in the film as this really vulnerable person, just even before you get to the monologue of like, this is a guy who's had drug issues, whose career's on the ropes, whose marriage is falling apart, or who's not going to get custody of his kid. He's out of money. He's desperate. He's gone back home. And then he gets folded into this hostage situation. And you're really playing with the, what is the difference between the action star who can rescue everybody and like a real ordinary person in a bad time in his life who's in this terrible situation? And it's so crazy and ridiculous, but it's a totally involving movie. And then in the midst of all of this, when he just floats up out of the scene and turns to the camera and goes into this monologue, it is one of the weirdest moments of, just in terms of the filmmaking, of any movie I can think of. You know, it is so completely bizarre. And I remember watching the first time and just going like, because I didn't know this was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, And I'm watching it going like, what is this? This is, he's talking to camera about his career and
breaking the fourth
wall. Just in a hostage situation. And then when it gets emotional and it gets genuinely, honestly, heartfelt, completely, I feel that it is 100% true. Like I mean, obviously he's acting because this is an acting job, but it is the best kind of acting where you go, this is a person who's just speaking the truth about himself in a totally open and vulnerable way. And I agree. I think it is an absolutely incredible performance. I don't, you know, obviously he can't go back to being the action star he is in the late 80s and early 90s because, you know, he's in the 60s, but like, but the fact that he could do this and make a movie that exposes so much of himself in such a powerful way is amazing.
Yeah. Everything we spoke about in terms of his past comes up in that monologue, being a 13-year-old kid who was scrawny and beat up, you know, turning himself into this thing. He has a moment where he shows his bicep, turned himself into this thing in order to become this star, put himself out there, went to those clubs with his headshot in hand, took the embarrassment, took the shame, fought back from people who were trying to abuse him, was homeless, had no money, stole to eat. All of that comes up. And then also fucked it all up, pissed it all away, got hooked on cocaine, let that ruin his life, went through the multiple wives, went through the things with his children, lost his money. And he does, as you said, swing it back to what's going on in the movie, talking about how now I've come back to Belgium. And this is where the tears start to flow, because you feel that pain to put my life back together, because I'm moving back home with my parents at this advanced age of my life. I fucked everything so badly that I'm having to move back into my folk. The great Jean-Claude Van Damme is moving back in with his parents in order to put his life back together. You know, it's funny. That's not out of the realm of possibility. Coming out real soon, one of the Spice Girls, Mel B, Scary Spice, she has written a memoir about her divorce where she lost all her money and had to move back in with her mother at this advanced age in order to be able to put herself back together again and get money and be in a position to be able to move out again. And it was all that she, the memoir is all about all she endured there as she lost all her money to fighting to get out of this marriage and how much this person took from her and through the course of the marriage and what she ended up with by the end. So it's a fascinating thing to be an artist, to be a creative. You're always, the big fear, I think, at least for me and multiple creatives I've spoken to, is this fear of being homeless, this fear of having no money by the end, this fear of like everyone else retiring with 401ks. What the hell do I have? And even one of those moments in the monologue, he says, I've been in these films, but what have I done for the world? What have I done for humanity? Right. I've left you nothing. And if I'm going to die in this bank, a bank heist, I'll have had no legacy to leave anything. And that was as naked as you could be, brother. And there's a great moment by the end of the by the end of that monologue where he just completely rips all the walls down and you see him for real. And then he yanks it all back because he has to in order to survive. And that is an amazing performance. So the fact that this is what separates him from the action stars of that time. Yeah. He was a legitimately damn good actor who studied his craft and understood how to be vulnerable and brought that out really in 2000. You don't think Seagal wouldn't have, Jeff Speakman, not even Norris would have been able to deliver a monologue that Van Damme could.
Well, I mean, Chuck Norris, if he did, we know that his tears cure cancer. Yeah, unfortunately, he's never cried.
That's right. Sadly, he's never cried.
I think that moment for me, you know what part of what makes it work for in that moment is I think because he's such a beautiful young man, is that seeing the lines in his face and his age, because this is who he is. You know what I mean? Like, and I mean, Seagal, you know, it's like, I don't know whether or not he snuck out of fighting Van Damme because he's afraid, but I'm very confident in saying he puts up a macho front because he's afraid, and that is the front that Van Damme takes down in that moment.
Yeah,
you know, he has the courage to be vulnerable. I mean, you know, Chuck, none of these people have the courage to be vulnerable.
Stallone in First Blood is the only thing I can remember in any semblance of an action film that mirrors what Van Damme does in that moment. You know, Stallone is just legitimately broken, representing Vietnam veterans, crying from his own experience of what he had to endure in order to achieve the things he's achieved. And it's all coming out, blurring fiction with reality. And it's an incredible thing. And you got to earn those moments.
And that movie, First Blood and JCVD, are both good, that when those monologues happen, as you said, Steve, they're jarring, but they're so effective that you are just shocked by the end of those monologues and have a whole new interpretation of the actor and the film itself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's I think JCVD, the film, is one of the crazy great moments in filmmaking in a completely bizarre way.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just like there's nothing. And again, I keep going back to this. What's happened to movies is there's nothing like that. Is someone someone went, we're going to make a movie that's totally unlike any other movie, you know?
Yeah. You know, and from there, he's been a part of the Kung Fu Panda series there as Master Croc. So it's been fun to see him part of it. He's done The Expendables, as I said. He went back to do Universal Soldier and did a few installments of that. He appeared in Kickboxer Vengeance as Master Duran there, and then in Kickboxer Retaliation. So later in life, he started showing up in these films. He was in Minions, The Rise of Gru as Jean-Claude, C-L-A-W-E-D. And even recently came back to lend his voice and his body to the Johnny Cage character for the Mortal Kombat 1 game that came out last year. So it's amazing how, you know, if you just hang around long enough, the wheel circles back around for you and you find yourself in these interesting positions with these interesting opportunities for yourself. And, you know, you stay relevant. You stay a part of the conversation in multiple mediums. And I think that's a fantastic thing for someone like Van Damme, who I know there's stuff off camera and there's obviously damage from the drugs and the medication and all this stuff. But like the fact that he is still someone who is revered in a certain way by a large number of us who grew up in his prime, I think is speaks volumes to the kind of person he is and the energy he has and why you and I are doing a show about a guy like this. And we're not doing a Seagal one. We're doing a Van Damme one. And there's a reason for that. And I think it's because we just feel a natural connection to a guy like this for many reasons.
No, I do feel that way. I do that. I think if we were to go into a Seagal one, obviously I have a lot to say about the martial arts.
Yeah.
He's just such an irritating. It's the opposite. He is such an irritating human.
Yes.
There's so much about him that just rubs you the wrong way that you don't want to hang out with the guy.
Yeah.
You know, like you just don't. Yeah. I don't want anything to do with it. And I'll say too, like, look, there are all sorts of great actors, writers, creators, artists of all sorts of kinds who have things in their past that we are uncomfortable with, that we don't like. Yeah. And my feeling about it is, and this is a conversation that we've had since the beginning of the Cinephiles.
Yep.
And my feelings have continued to evolve. And this is where I am now, is that I don't think we should be throwing away people because they do things that we don't like. And I think that for people that commit crimes, there should be punishment for those crimes.
Absolutely.
For people that offend, they should issue they should do their best to apologize and make amends.
Yeah.
But I'm not throwing them out. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there are people like Harvey Weinstein, who's a truly horrible person and should be in jail for his crimes.
Right.
But I'm still going to watch Good Will Hunting or Shakespeare in Love or other great movies that he's made, you know, that he was involved in. Like it's just. And I will even say the guy was a horrible fucking person, but had a lot of talents that were great. And we can admire some of the talents that were great while saying those things about him. And people like Jean-Claude Van Damme, who have some skeletons in their closet, those aren't criminals. You know what I mean? Like they're not horrible people. They're flawed people like I'm flawed and like you're flawed that made mistakes in the public eye and have tried to move on from them. And so it's like, you know, I just don't.
Yeah,
I think we need to work real hard on being more forgiving and less judgmental as audience members and fans.
More graceful, you know? Is what you're saying. Yeah, and I appreciate it.
Yeah,
for sure. I'll work on it, Dad. All right, let's. that
wasn't what I was saying.
I know it. Let's move on to some Streamlabs and Super Chats as we wrap up this discussion, as we're over an hour already. Carlton Rudder says, London calling. Sorry I couldn't join you guys live. My favorite JCVD movie is Time Cop, a great 90s action movie. Hope you are both keeping well. Yeah, Steve, I recently saw about an hour of it on Pluto. As I've told you, Pluto is my place to go. And it was randomly on, and I watched an hour of it. And I was like, look, this feels dated, but I don't give a shit. I'm enjoying the hell out of it. So, absolutely. I agree with Carlton. It's a damn good one. JMB says, absolutely two of the best to do deep dives into movies. Oh, thank you. My question is, of JCVD's oeuvre, which ones would you guys like to see get a modern remake? And who would you choose to lead them? Thanks, guys. Great question. Steve, do
So here, I mean, here's the thing. I think for the most part, these are high concept films, and it's like, as I said before, you can plug anybody into Bloodsport. You can plug anybody into Kickboxer. Sure. You can plug anybody into Time Cop. What I'm kind of curious about it is I'm just sort of thinking of like, well, who is the next great martial arts action star? You know, I don't know who that person is. And it is interesting because there are, what's interesting now is that it used to be that mainstream movies didn't have good fight scenes in the martial arts kind of sense.
Right.
And that is no longer true. Like now, as we've talked about with Marvel movies and all sorts of other films, the expectation when you have a fight scene is it's going to be at a great martial arts level fight scene.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I have it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and he's a perfect example of someone who I think moves great and could totally star in a bunch of martial arts movies, you know? What do you think?
Simu Liu would be my choice. Put him in any of these movies as a remake, and I think he'd be fantastic. I think it'd be fun to see him in something like Bloodsport. It'd be great to see him in something like Double Impact because he's legitimately a damn good actor. So seeing Simu Liu play two different versions of himself, I think would be really fascinating to see. Or Time Cop, right? A futuristic sci-fi film about time travel, especially now updated to what we know when we've seen some really good sci-fi adaptations about time travel or about cops in the future, as we saw with Minority Report. I think it could be really fascinating to explore that with a new take nowadays. I think Simu would be great to be in something like that. And we've seen martial arts come in, making a bit of a, you know, we certainly see it in the John Wick movies, a bit of a comeback, even though they're gun-fu, they're still martial artists. And recently in The Acolyte, the first two episodes of The Acolyte have a lot of what people are calling now force-fu in the combo of Jedi having martial arts training. And we see the two separate fights in the first two episodes that are all martial arts and pretty incredible. So I think the taste for that is starting to come back and people want to see it more and more.
Frankly, I think the John Wick movies, those are the air. That is the modern equivalent of going to see this kind of just, you know, nonstop balls to the wall sort of action sequences. And those movies are so good in terms of the fight choreography and how much attention to details put into them. My big request, but I don't know if it'll succeed, is like, let's keep the budgets low. Let's crank out some, let's do a bunch of them. Let's get a bunch of movies. Don't put a ton of money into them and see if somebody emerges. Yeah. That's what I would like. I would like to see the film world doing more low budget action movies. That's what I would like.
Fair point. Steve S. just sent in. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
JMB says, speaking of knockoff Bruce Lee's, there's an anime called Naruto that has a hand-to-hand prodigy whose name is Rock Lee. I dub Roka Lee. Oh my god. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I've never seen this anime, but I know Naruto is who Yuri Lowenthal voices him over, who I used to host the show with. So I'll have to ask him about it. But thank you, JMB. Very kind of you. Steve S says, this is what he's trying to say. Hi, John and Steve. I love your podcast. Years ago, I was about 8 years old and posed for a school photo with my two sisters. I was in the middle, gritting my teeth like Van Damme did, ruined the picture.
Well, I think that Van Damme inspired you to create a memorable picture that you are still thinking about many, many years later.
Yeah.
You wouldn't even, without Jean-Claude Van Damme's incredible influence on your posing ability, you would not be thinking about this very special picture today.
Yeah. And at least you didn't go, you're from Bloodsport. Don Ronaldo McWhiskey. Hey, Don, good to see you. He says, loving the episode, loving the discussion, loving the comments in the chat. Cheers, gents. Oh, thanks, Don.
Thank you very much, Don.
Absolutely. JMB says, who likes to be shirtless more, JCVD or Kirk? Ooh, that's a tough
one. I can answer this. No, it's not tough at all.
It's not.
As a person who is, the question is the question JCVD or Kirk, or is the question JCVD or Shatner?
I think it's
because Shatner definitely did not want to be shirtless throughout the original series, because every time they had him do it, he had to shave his chest.
Oh,
and he hated it and objected to it every time. And it's not that he was struggling a ton with his weight during the original series, but he did put on a few pounds a couple of times and then had to slim down. So he definitely was opposed to taking his shirt off a lot of the time.
So there was, we'll go with JCVD. I'll agree with that as well. All right, and then we have a stream lab that came through from Fredtastic. Thank you, Fred. He says, Time Cop is my top Van Damme.
If I have one complaint about that movie, it's that it looks like they ran out of budget when they designed their future cars. Overall, I enjoy Van Damme's movies. Yeah, I think you might be right on that one. The cars mm-hmm. looked a bit thrown together, shall we say.
Well, it's also the thing. I always love the quote, which I think Walt Disney really said, which is that we should have called Tomorrowland Yesterdayland, because you spend so much time thinking about designing the future, and by the time you already get it built, it's already out of date. You know, it's great like
point.
And if you look at science fiction from any era, you can go, oh yeah, this is 70s science fiction.
This is
how they thought the future would look in the 60s. Well, you're looking at 90s science fiction in Time Cop, and you know, some things will hit and some things will definitely not hit, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, let's wrap up our conversation here, Steve. Is there anything you want to make sure we bring up, or are we good to wrap up here, my friend?
I here's one other thing I would say, which is that I think, like me seeing Enter the Dragon when I was 9 years old, one of the other important things about martial arts superstars is they inspire a whole bunch of little kids to put on a gi, you know, put it on a uniform and to a dojo and start training in one way or another. And so I think that's a pretty cool thing just for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And quite a lot of people have said that they were influenced by Van Damme. There is a statue of Van Damme there in Brussels to honor him and how he brought fame to the city. But Nick Diaz, George St. Pierre, Mirko Krokop, Rico Verhoeven, Charles Rosa, Dave Callahan, Scott Adkins, all of these fighters, George St. Pierre, all of these fighters talk about how much Van Damme influenced them to get into martial arts. And so it's an incredible legacy he leaves. And even the wrestler, which I wanted to show Steve, I don't know if Steve knows this wrestler, but this is a wrestler named Rob Van Damme, and he absolutely took the moniker as an homage to Jean-Claude Van Damme because he kind of looks like him.
He does kind of look like him, yeah.
And he wrestles like him with a lot of martial arts, he does the splits as one of his things. He does a lot of flexible movements and stuff off the top rope. And so that was that's another legacy of Van Damme, that a wrestler who became one of the most famous and greatest wrestlers ever took his last name, which of course is a fake last name that he came up with, but took it upon himself to continue the legacy there in the wrestling ring. So it's incredible stuff, man. So final thoughts here on Van Damme, and where you think we might see him, because he's 63. I think if I'm looking at the time, he's 63 years old. His birthday's coming up in October here. Where do you see this gentleman going in the next few years, and what are your final words here on Jean-Claude Van Damme as we leave this conversation?
Having watched his performance in JCVD, I let's give this guy a streaming TV show. I think doing like a hardboiled detective or a thing that's a little grittier, where he's, you know, can play like, and maybe he's sort of the older man of a buddy partnership with a young rookie or something like that.
Yeah,
I think there's some stuff that he can do. Like, in particular, you know, we think about like the, you know, Popeye Doyle kind of character in French Connection, of a guy that's got some problems and some struggles, but is still an old tough guy that you have to respect. That's what I want to see. That's the thing I would love to see him do. I think he would be great at it. And I think there would be a lot of people that would show up for that, you know?
Yeah, he had a streaming series in 2017 called Jean-Claude Val Johnson, where he essentially played himself solving these crimes, which was an interestingly weird, kind of like Mike Tyson when he was having that animated series where Mike Tyson was solving crimes. What you're talking about, I think I'm more interested in that, which is him playing this hard-nosed cop who's trying to solve these crimes or whatever. That was more tongue-in-cheek. I think this could be a different approach that I would love to see more of the harder edge to him and what he could do overall. So yeah, I would absolutely love to see that. I think we're not done with Van Damme, 63 years old. He's, you know, this is a guy who still looks fantastic. For those of you who watched that Christian Harloff interview with him a few years ago, was it 3 or 4 years ago? The dude is off his rocker at times, but he is endlessly entertaining and fascinating. And I think that's an element that has to be part of whatever TV show, streaming or otherwise, or film that you make with him down the road, to keep him kind of someone that people want to watch and see in these situations and in these projects. So for me, I wish him nothing but the best. I thank him for all the years of entertainment, the years of enjoyment I've gotten from watching his stuff. And I hope he's gone through all his wars and he's come out the other side and he's enjoying his life now in the twilight of his life. And hopefully there's another twist or two in the tale to help us reappreciate him again in another project down the road. So we shall see. All right. Well, thank you all so much for the Streamlabs and the Super Chats. Thank you very much for the lively chat we had through this whole conversation. We appreciate it madly. And Steve, what do we have to tell the people who are listening to us or watching us right now?
Well, we would tell them that as we announce our next full movie on the Cinephiles will be Total Recall, Paul Verhoeven and Arnold Schwarzenegger. They can always buy or stream that film along with every other movie we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net. They can support the show either through subscribing at Apple Podcasts, which will give them access to ad-free versions of the show and our Cinephile shorts, or on patreon.com/thecinephiles, which will give them access to that. And at other levels, also our watch along, they provide actual questions that appear in our shows. And of course, joining our advisory board, which is awesome and has helped us chart the course for the Cinephiles in the future. And if they want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
There you go. And if you want to reach me, you can follow me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Please remember to subscribe to the channel down below. We're trying to build the Cinephiles YouTube channel out. So subscribe down below and hit that bell button so you see when we're dropping live shows just like this and our other shows that pop up here as we go along on the YouTube channel. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/JohnRocaSays. If you can subscribe there, I'd love that as well. And my other podcasts that are out there for you to enjoy, the Geek Buddies and the Hot Mic and the Jedi Way. Thank you all so much for hanging out with us. As Steve said, look for part one of Total Recall next week. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new live episode of The Cinephiles here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. Take care. Peace.